The religion of Islam, or at least its more active adherents, have had trouble staying out of the headlines for years now. And while lots of people are quick to form opinions of Islam, some of them run a little short of the facts. Today's guest set out to change that. Stephen Scholl is co-author with Sam Deeb of a slender but fact-packed book about and titled The Prophet of Islam, Muhammad. Stephen Scholl lived in the Middle East and traveled extensively there after pursuing graduate studies in Islamic philosophy and history at McGill University in Montreal. His scholarly focus is on Islam and comparative religions, and he is the founding publisher of White Cloud Press, based in Ashland, so no surprise which company publishes the book.
Random House, yes, took that on. No, White Cloud Press is proud to have this book out.
So, Stephen, tell us about yourself and your co-author. We know a little bit about you. Tell us a bit more about Sam Deeb.
Sam is based in Kuwait. He lives partly in Australia, partly in Kuwait. He's a Muslim. I met him at the Islamic Society of North America convention, which is held every Labor Day weekend. And he just sort of popped into my booth and said he had this book and if I'd be interested. And so we looked at it and I said, well, maybe if we massage it a little bit, why don't I be your co-author and we'll make it really for a general readership. He has a PhD and is a very smart, sharp fellow.
So why Islamic studies? As a non-Muslim yourself, what compelled you to learn so much about Islam?
Well, it's interesting. I grew up without any religious training, interest. I always say that, you know, our family gathered every night in front of the family altar and we turned it on and watched it. And we, you know, we were a leave it to Beaver, father knows best kind of, and religion was irrelevant. It was just not something. I remember waking up one day when I was 16 years old going, you know, after listening to Donovan and Van Morrison and Bob Dylan, who have all these sort of spiritual references, and going, what is this religious stuff? And so I kind of set out on a quest, you know, like a lot of people back in the late 60s and 70s. And that's to the horror of my family, I became to them sort of this religious nut. But, you know, it was not typical. I didn't become a Christian. I didn't become a Jew. I didn't become a Buddhist. I sort of like dove into everything.
You became an omnivore.
Exactly.
So it's not a particularly spiritual devotion, but certainly an intellectual one.
It was an intellectual, but also a personal spiritual quest of sorts. But I think the fact that I came from no background made me a little bit leery of jumping into any one. You know, I could see the good in each one of them. I could also see the bad. And once you start and that sort of led me into an academic career. And once you start studying religion academically, all hell breaks loose because you start academics ask different questions than believers do mm-hmm. of the text, of the traditions. And so I came into it with a very critical in the positive sense of critical, that, you know, that you're looking at, you know, trying to understand deeply what forces are at play in the world. And religion is a very important one. So I became fascinated with world religions. I really started off in India, like most kids back in the 60s, mm-hmm. you know, we were questing. And I thought I was going to be doing Hindu-Buddhist kinds of studies. But I just sort of gradually kept drifting back to the Mediterranean and finding the mystical traditions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam fascinating. So that led me to Islamic studies. I fell in love with the Sufi poets, Rumi, Hafez, and that's sort of how I moved into this area.
But I can see how somebody who approaches this from a scholarly level asks different questions, as you put it, because for one thing, people who are people of faith within those religions don't tend to ask those kinds of questions at all, I would think. I mean, they're not going to question the religion itself because it is the basis for who they are.
Yeah, it's tough. And I have several Christian friends, ministers, who have confided in me, you know, saying that, you know, what they, you know, they ask different questions of than their congregation does. And sometimes they're at odds with their congregations because they are thinking about these things in a little bit different way. And so they sort of see themselves as trying to move the conversations in a certain direction. And religion is one of the easiest things in the world to mock and to get riled up over because of its behind the times, you know, points of view around all sorts of issues, you know, women, gender orientation, all these kinds of things, science. But, you know, religion also has incredible things to offer the world. And, you know, so that's it's a mix of the good and the bad and sometimes, sadly, the ugly.
Muhammad is certainly not an undercovered subject. So what is your approach in this book with Sam Deeb?
Well, this is not the best book on Muhammad out on the market. It's not the most comprehensive. But what Sam and I really wanted to do was make it readable and make it a user-friendly book. I mean, it's a little tiny book. I mean,
is it 4x5 or something?
Something like that. It's yeah, and it's.
It looks like a guidebook, or
it looks like a guidebook. Yeah, we really kind of wanted it to be a guidebook to Muhammad and to Islamic culture. So there's lots of. I mean, there's over. I think there's what 200 and there's almost 300 or 240 pages in the book and over 300 color photographs and illustrations. So we wanted it to be something that people could look up and find information easily, quickly, and get. My theory here is there's a book out by Stephen Prothero, who's a Harvard scholar of religion, called Religious Literacy. And he looks at Americans and what do we know about religion? And he says basically we're flunking. We're one of the most religious countries in the Western world, and we don't actually know anything about religion. You know, if you ask somebody basic questions. So this is I think that everyone should know some of the basic facts of the world religions, and this is an attempt to say, okay, here's a quick, easy way for you to find out about Muhammad.
All right, we'll learn a lot more about Muhammad and about the process of assembling this book from Stephen Scholl when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange. We'll take your phone calls and emails as well. Back here with Stephen Scholl and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our topic today is Muhammad, the last prophet of Islam, the Muhammad. He is profiled in a book out from White Cloud Press in Ashland called The Prophet of Islam, Muhammad. It's more like a guidebook, a little 4x6 book with lots and lots of pictures, but lots and lots of useful facts as well. Stephen Scholl is the co-author with Sam Deeb. Steve is also the founder of White Cloud Press. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Muhammad and the issues that have been created by Muhammad and the religion he left behind. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Check out our Facebook page as well, and you can see a picture of Stephen sitting in the studio. Can we safely guess that being something of an expert on Muhammad, that you've not been invited to speak on Fox News very much?
I haven't got the invitation yet, but I'm putting it out there. This is, it's interesting. The media has a really interesting relationship with Muhammad and Islam. You know, it's like I was saying earlier, religion in general is easy to take on and pull down, and obviously Islam, in light of 9/11, in light of what happened in Paris. There's issues here that are difficult.
Who is the book made for? I mean, it is a very digestible book, as we pointed out. It looks like a tourist guidebook, lots of photographs, and it's 240 pages. So who is the primary audience you're thinking this will be useful to?
It's really non-Muslims who, whenever I go out and talk, most Americans are very clear and will say, I don't know anything about Islam. I don't know, you know, I don't know the difference between a Shiite and a Sunni and a Sufi and a Wahhabi. And what are all these things? So really, you know, that's who I'm hoping to reach is, again, this to try and create a little bit of clarity around, you know, I mean, our country went into Iraq without a clear understanding. I mean, and I'm talking about members of the Bush administration, of the difference between a Shiite and a Sunni in a country that was about divided 50-50 between the two. And all hell broke loose again. It's like, you know, information helps us understand our world, and that's really what I'm after.
For the person who knows Islam but does not practice Islam, and I'm talking about you here, what is the biggest lack of knowledge? I mean, what are some of the biggest misconceptions you find?
Well, it starts with Muhammad. Muhammad is viewed as a warmonger, a pedophile. And these are not new claims. I mean, they go back centuries, and so they've been recycled and recycled and recycled. So things really start off, you know, but I think the other things is, one of the biggest things is that Islam preaches the killing of infidels, meaning the killing of anybody who is a non-Muslim. That's not true. Infidel is a translation of a word that really is very specific. And it does not mean anybody, does not mean anybody who is a non-Muslim. It's a very specific category. So
does it mean somebody who's an enemy of Islam, though? And
it means Islam was born in an age of violence, and there's no getting around that. And Islam was attacked from the very beginning because it really went against the status quo of the a ruling elite in the Arabian Peninsula in the 7th century that controlled everything. And Muhammad was going up against that ruling elite. Like he was, part of the 99% going against the 1%ers. And they thought they came after him hard. They attacked, they killed his followers. So there was this whole thing of somebody who attacks the faith and this could be considered a kufr or an infidel. And that person would be what we would call a traitor, treason. And in most cultures, someone who is a traitor and commits treason has penalties, and usually it's the death penalty. So, but a Christian, a Jew, other religious people, other civilians are not in that category. So, when there is these phrases that all of these difficult verses that we have from the Quran that people cherry pick out and say, oh, this means this, it comes without this contextualization of what the phrase actually means in the context of its time.
So, and the book begins with a very direct reference to, a disclaimer, basically, about references to Muhammad by name, because his name is usually followed by a phrase.
Right. So within a Muslim context, when you mention the name of the prophet or any other prophet, whether it's Jesus, Moses, Joseph, Abraham, Adam, they say a phrase, peace be upon him. And so the original book that Sam brought to me, used that elocution, and for our non-Muslim readers, it just becomes a burdensome thing, and we don't think in those terms, and so we modified the book a little bit so that it still conveyed that we really want people not to be to read the book and not go, oh well, I don't, what's all this piety here? So we're our goal is again education and understanding, and the more of that we have, the less, it's just something we need, the world needs around this topic desperately.
Even before page one, you explain the very meaning of the name Muhammad. What does that mean?
Really, it's one who's praiseworthy. Muhammad was known for his, before all this prophet stuff hit him, he was known also as by the name Amin, which means the trustworthy one. He has all these qualities of character that we all, we would admire in any person. And he really lived his name. His life reflected those qualities of being someone who was worthy of praise and trust.
Now, you as a person who studies comparative religions, you see a lot in common with the Abrahamic religions.
Yeah.
Judaism, Christianity, Islam. It seems like the deeper a person's faith gets, the less they see the similarities between them.
It's a really interesting thought, Jeff, because in a lot of ways, when you look across religions, like Houston Smith is one of America's great scholars of comparative religion, world religions. And he's always kind of doing this comparison where you can see connections between Hinduism and Judaism and all this kind of stuff. And a lot of times it's like the closer you look at within a religion, the more differences you can see. So for example, a Muslim and a Christian might get along fine, but a Sunni and a Shiite might really have difficulty because they're really closer. You know, it's like family squabbles. The family internal family debates can be harsher and more critical than the ones across families.
Oh, so, standing inside the religion, inside the family, in this sense, like, no, you're wrong. No, you're wrong.
Exactly.
Very much like sibling relationships.
Yeah. But there is so much more in common within. I mean, 1/3 of the Quran is retelling of stories from the Bible. And most, you know, non-Muslims don't get that. Yeah, that really Muhammad embraced the Judeo-Christian stories. He loved them, and they were a part. They became a part of the Quran. They became a part of their faith. So, you know, Muslims oftentimes are very protective of Jesus and Mary and Moses and so forth. You know, so there really is an Abrahamic family. One quick story: I work with a group out of Jerusalem called the Jerusalem Peacemakers. These are Muslims, Jews, and Christians who get together to share their lives together. Mm-hmm. And when the first times they got together, first they kind of put the Christians to the side, and they brought the Jews and the Muslims together, the rabbis and the imams. And things were a little tense in the room. And finally, one of the rabbis says, "My grandfather knew the Quran by heart." The rabbi knew the Quran by heart. Then one of the imams says, "Well, my grandfather, you know, knew the Hebrew Bible backwards and forwards." And they got into a bragging contest of who knew more about the other tradition. Because just a generation or two ago, those communities were really tight. The Jews and the Muslims in Palestine were really, and throughout the Middle East, were really close. They sometimes when the Jewish community had a difficulty, they would go to the sheikh, and sometimes when the Jewish community would have a difficulty, they would go to the the Muslim scholars. And so, because they knew each other's traditions, so there is this history of reciprocity and cultural exchange between these communities. And really, in a lot of ways, Islam and Judaism share a ton of, I mean, they're really close cousins.
We're talking to Stephen Scholl on the Jefferson Exchange about Muhammad. He is the co-author with Sam Deeb of a book called The Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, a small and rather slender volume, but packed with facts and pictures. And it's sort of like a guidebook for the people who don't know Muhammad and Islam to get to know both of those better. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760, jx@jeffnet.org by email. Check us out on Facebook, and you can see Stephen sitting in our studio from a photo from a few moments ago. There is a historical advantage, I understand, in studying Muhammad versus, say, studying Jesus.
Well, we know a lot more about Muhammad's life. It's well documented. He lived in a later time. He lived... And he was a much more public figure in the sense that his religious revolution would sort of change the Arabian world and the greater world very quickly was well documented. And so we know, you know.
You got sources other than scripture to draw on.
Exactly. And so if, you know, there was this continues to be this big movement within Christianity of the asking the question, what would Jesus do? And with Jesus, we really, you know, don't have a lot. There's kind of thin material there in terms of, so it's really kind of an open question. You try to put yourself into that and try to imagine, well, okay, what with Muhammad, it's an embarrassment of riches, because if you say, well, what would Muhammad do? Well, we pretty much know how, you know, I mean, everything from how he ate food to how he shook hands to how he, you know, treated his, friends and relatives. So there's a lot of information we have about Muhammad, and a lot of it is inaccurate in terms of that it kind of grew after, you know, that there's materials in this literature that is clearly false and had been added on.
This tale grew in the telling, that sort of thing.
Yes. And but still there is a core level of material that scholars can look at and decide, yes, this looks like it is authentic and goes back and is an authentic description of something that happened in Muhammad's life.
And there are even detailed physical descriptions and, in fact, pictures. There are pictures of Muhammad in existence. But then you get into this whole strange realm of why Muhammad is so seldom depicted. And online, you can find lots of pictures of Muhammad where the face may have been there at one time, has been scratched out, or he's depicted with veils, depicted with long sleeves, so you can't see skin of any kind. What is the what goes on there with that depiction of Muhammad himself? Because there are other faces in those same pictures.
Right. There is a real strong part of this is a reaction against certain trends that were prevalent within the Christian world when Islam emerged and was being born. Islam does not share with Christianity the idea that Jesus was divine and human. Nor is Muhammad. Muhammad is a man. He is a prophet. He is guided by God. But there's always, so there's a sense of not deifying the prophet. And early Muslims felt that this was what happened in Christianity. And so there's a verse in the Quran that says, you know, God is neither begets or is begotten. He's not a father figure. He doesn't create kids. And so so it's really this attempt to not go in a theological direction by deifying any human being, whether it's Muhammad or, you know. So now within the Muslim world, there's this, I was listening to Morning Edition a couple days ago, and David Green was referencing the fact that it is forbidden for pictures of Muhammad to exist according to Islamic teachings. That's not true. There's nothing in the Quran about this. There's really not that much. And within the Muslim world, there are depictions of Muhammad, especially in the Shiite world, in the Shia world. There's a whole tradition of painting the prophet. But there's also a very strong tradition within the Muslim world of not doing that. So there's, again, 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, a lot of diversity. There's not a cut and dry, but in general, there is a religious sensibility of not wanting to have a lot of glorification of humans as beings that can be deified. And so
idolatry.
Islamic art, architecture is very geometric and very, you know, it's a more nuanced and complex
So why mosques are not decorated as Christian churches are with the pictures of saints and statues and all that sort of thing.
Right.
Got it. Grab your headphones. We have some phone calls for you. Let us go first to Joe in Dillard. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Stephen Scholl, the author of The Prophet of Islam, Muhammad.
Yeah, good morning. I read a book recently by William Bolitho called The 12 Against the Gods, and he had some stories in there about Muhammad. One of them I would like to check with you and see if you've heard anything about Muhammad's camel. Do you remember the name of Muhammad's camel? I can't remember that the camel had a name. But it seemed to me like Muhammad gained a lot of fame because he had, like, the fastest camel around. Camels seemed to be very important to the people at that time in that area. Could you comment on that, please? Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the question, Joe.
Well, I'm going to take this in a little bit different direction. I don't recall the name. I know Muhammad did have a number of camels, and there was one that was particularly, but I can't remember, merit and so forth, but I don't remember the camel's name. But camels were critically important in this part of the world. And because they were, Muhammad was his profession, he was a merchant, and he was a trader. He traded goods. And there was this, about two generations before his birth, something happened that was very, you know, could be a little bit small, but it ended up being big, and it dealt with camels. The Arab tradesmen figured out a way to saddle camels in a new way so that suddenly the camels could carry massive amounts of goods. And this changed everything. And suddenly the Arabian Peninsula, which was sort of a backwater area in terms of between the Persian culture to the north and the Byzantine Christian culture to the north, became extremely important, and Muslims began, the camels were sort of like the super tankers of the time, and suddenly massive amounts of wealth just before Muhammad's time became pouring into the Arabian Peninsula, and it changed everything. And so camels were very, very important. And Muhammad was very much involved with them as a camel caravan leader who traveled up into Damascus and into and towards Egypt and so forth. And he got a great education of the cultural diversity of his time. He was involved with the superpowers through trading. And camels are a big deal.
So exposed certainly to other cultures in the time, and this is a big increase in the prestige and knowledge of the Arabian Peninsula there before Muhammad's time in the 7th century. Stephen Scholl is the co-author with Sam Deeb of The Prophet of Islam, Muhammad. We have other calls waiting and a couple of emails as well. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and take those and talk more to Stephen in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about Muhammad, the prophet and creator of Islam. He is profiled in a new book called The Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, co-written by Sam Deeb and Stephen Scholl. Stephen Scholl is the publisher of White Cloud Press in Ashland, and White Cloud Press puts out the book. He's the co-author of the book as well, and a scholar of comparative religions and Islam for many years now. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions or comments, 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. This email is from Mike in Medford. He says, studying the Abrahamic religions always makes me come to this question. Why isn't there agreement between the three religions that they share the same God? They may differ in practices, but it all starts with old Abe. Is Islamic extremism a new phenomenon? The time of Muhammad seemed to be a much more prosperous era for the Middle East than many of them are third world countries. So a couple different parts to that, but it's all from Mike in Medford.
Well, there is a verse in the Quran that says, God could have created us to be one happy family, but he didn't. And he says, and there should be no compulsion in religion, and that the different religions should strive to compete against each other in acts of kindness and goodness. So what, and it's interesting because when Muhammad first began preaching, he really felt he was sort of a two minds, it seems like, in the early days. One is that his revelations that were coming through him that become the Quran were really for the Arab people, and that they would be partners with Jews and Christians, and that they each, basically he says, your religion is good to the Jews, your religion is good to the Christians, and here's a new one, and we're your brothers. So this is the beginning of it. And but unfortunately, humans have a tendency of breaking up into groups and fighting over things, whether it's, you know, and it's just, I mean, this is the big question of, you know, why is there violence? Why is human nature the way it is and so forth? You know, why do we still go to Shakespeare plays to look at, you know, people act in horrible ways towards each other and try to figure it out? So there's no easy, good, and, you know, quick answer, because, boy, you know, there, and a part of what religion really is trying to do is handle this question of, boy, there's something really beautiful and good about human nature, and there's some stuff that's really bad and difficult. You know, we are violent creatures. We fight, you know, and Islam has a checkered history of being both the bastions of civilization and creative science and architecture and medicine, the Golden Age. You know, it was the Muslims who preserved the Greek philosophy through a translation campaign, translating Greek text, as the Christian world was trying to destroy all these texts, the Muslims were trying to save them. So there's, you know, and then Islam has had its dark periods, and just as Christianity has had its bright moments and its dark periods. So it's, you know, I think one of the things I'm interested in, and I think most Americans are, is I'm interested in trying to be fair in understanding the differences that exist out there. And, again, you know, Islamic extremism is something that can only be understood in the aftermath of several centuries of Western domination of these regions. You know, there's a lot of animosity in the region towards this legacy of resource extraction from the area not to the benefit of the masses of the people. So there's also, I mean, Islamic extremism is a fact that we need to wrestle with, both, and Muslims need to wrestle with, and Muslims are wrestling with it.
Let's take another call. We have Paul and Slater. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Stephen Scholl, the co-author of The Prophet of Islam, Muhammad.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Stephen's quite interesting in presenting a pretty cleaned up version of Muhammad, and there are a couple of questions I have and a couple of statements I'd like to make. I didn't know about the camels being the super tankers of the desert, and that was quite interesting. I'd never considered that before, and it opened up trade. And Mr. Muhammad was a businessman, essentially. And, of course, in his days, people communicated around campfires and whatnot. And so I'm sure he was a center of attention for lots of folks. But there's a couple things that I know about the religion through having business relationships for about 3 or 4 years with a group of Sunnis and Shia and other groups, and had a little insight. And one of the things that struck me, and you might comment on, Stephen, is the fact that young boys, repeat boys, in many of those Muslim countries, they learn to read with the Quran, and they read nothing else, and they read it over and over again. And it brings to my mind the Catholic Jesuits and the famous saying about, give me the child to age 7, and I'll show you the man. And I saw it daily with my Arab friends who praised Hitler to the skies. And I said, no, you guys aren't looking at the broad picture of this. But they were so inculcated with this stuff that there was a Jew behind every tree. And Allah was going to point him out, and you could go kill him. And they absolutely believed in it. And these were engineers and educated people. And they were nice, lovely people in all but that area. And to cast aspersions on Fox News and President Bush in a program like this is really out of line, Michael.
Well, actually, the joke about Fox News came from me, but let's move this off to Stephen and get a response. Thanks for the call, Paul.
Well, it's a hard one to address.
Let's start with the factual parts first. Yeah. about learning to read with the Quran. Is that frequently true?
The Quran the Quran is considered the most elevated Arabic language that's out there. So using the Quran as a primer for learning to read is common, but not universal, especially even in the Arab world. I mean, most Muslims are not Arabs. Most Muslims don't speak Arabic. So most of them don't go through this kind of education. So, I've had similar experiences that Paul has had with deeply prejudicial anti-Semitic views that some Muslims and Arabs have had, and that, in my experience, has been a very minority, point of view. Does it exist? Yes.
Right, but the exception, not the rule, is what you
think. It's not the rule, no.
Okay. So back to Muhammad himself, because I want to get back on track here. The character descriptions of him, he sounds like a simple man, friendly, didn't shoot lasers from his eyes, any of that sort of thing. Yeah. And how did he live? I mean, what do we know about his...
Simply.
No particularly opulent home or anything like that?
No, he had a very sparse... house that was part of the mosque, the first mosque in the city of Medina. He ate, even once there was success, and this is part of the history. Islam begins in persecution towards it. It triumphs and becomes the dominant religion, and really, and even in Muhammad's lifetime, Islam took over the Arabian Peninsula completely, and within 70 years of his life, it ruled from throughout the Iranian plateau into throughout North Africa all the way to Spain. So it was a dramatic change of fortunes. And but even through that, he continued to live a very simple, frugal life.
So what came before Muhammad in terms of religion? Was it generally tribal? I mean, quote unquote, pagan,
yes.
Polytheistic religion?
Yeah, there was a memory of monotheism in the culture, but it was had been overlaid with multiple pagan deities. Each tribal group had its own ruling deities and so forth. And in Mecca, there was this Kaaba building, which goes back in myth to, or in legend, to the prophet Abraham.
It's just black granite block.
Well, it's actually just the black is a draping curtain over it. It's not black granite. Inside, there's a black meteor that was in part of the foundation of it, but it's just a stone building with a. And inside that building during Muhammad's time, before Islam became the religion, there were over 300 deities, and that was the faith. And so Muhammad came and said, "No, I believe in one God." He tried to restore this, and he said, "This is the God of Abraham, the God of Moses, the God of Jesus, and it's the God that I'm preaching." So he revolutionized that culture.
And he swept the idols out of the Kaaba.
Yeah. So he came in and he removed them all, and except for there were statues of Jesus and Mary, and he left those.
Interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So then the spread of Islam, I can't get out of my mind one of the accounts I read years ago, mm-hmm. and it was started with a subordinate clause: militant from the beginning, comma, mm-hmm. and then went on to tell the story of Islam. Was it always spread by the sword?
Well, yes and no. It's interesting. Again, I want to go back to the sense that Muhammad's ministry began with him not just saying that there was one God. The other part of the main message is that Muhammad was an orphan. He lost both of his parents. He was raised, and to be an orphan in a tribal society means you're under duress. You're vulnerable. So throughout the early revelations that come through the Quran to Muhammad, there is a strong emphasis on social justice and protection of the weak, the orphans, girls, all these kinds of things are really part of it. So he was going against all of the social status that was dominating the culture of the elite group that controlled the traffic and controlled the Kaaba and controlled the trade and so forth. And so that's why they came after him so hard. And it was a tribal situation where there was fighting, but the fighting, when Islam spread out and took over, for example, when the Muslim armies came to Jerusalem, they were not spreading the religion. They did not try to convert. They actually went out of their way to say that they made all of the synagogues and churches in Jerusalem sacred and inviolate. And they weren't actually trying to convert people. They were trying to control the region. But conversion actually came years and years later and was mostly done by Sufis. So the military aspect was they wanted to control the land and the area, but they also wanted the tax revenues, and they wanted to keep basically the people embraced the Muslim conquerors because they were so much more fair and just than the Persians and the Byzantines, and they got a better shake. So the conversion actually starts much later after that, there's very little military conversion to the religion.
There is a tomb of Muhammad, as you point out in the book. Mm-hmm. Where is that, and why is there also then the Dome of the Rock? Mm-hmm. In Jerusalem.
So Muhammad's grave and tomb is in Medina, which is the city about a couple hundred miles north of Mecca. So Mecca is sort of the spiritual center of where the Kaaba is. But Muhammad kind of did most of his operations out of Medina because he had to flee Mecca because of persecution. So there is a story of – there's an event that happens in Muhammad's life. It's called the ascension, where he one night he finds himself in a dream state going to Jerusalem.
The night voyage, the mirage.
The mirage to Jerusalem. And then from Jerusalem on this rock, he shoots up into heaven and encounters the various prophets. So that's where the Dome of the Rock is. It's based upon this night journey of Muhammad's that started in Medina, went off to Jerusalem. And this is, you know, this is a spiritual tale, but many believers find it literally true.
And so, how to finish up, because we have just a little bit of time left. Mm-hmm. There are 10 commandments in Islam as well as in Christian and Jewish religion?
Well, Muslims have sort of adopted and come up with their equivalent to those, and they're very similar. You know, right action, right, do the right things, basically.
And be straight, you bring up in the book. This is something Muhammad said, not in English, obviously, but...
Yeah. Yeah, to do the right thing. You know, I mean, really what Muhammad is always asking, Muhammad says... It's important to know that everything you do has a spiritual consequence, so do the right thing.
All right. Well, obviously we could spend another hour on this, but this is the one we had, and I really want to thank you for coming in. Stephen Scholl is the publisher of White Cloud Press and the co-author with Sam Deeb of The Prophet of Islam, Muhammad. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks, Jeff.
Great to have you.